From Entrepreneur Media, this is Problem Solvers, a show in which entrepreneurs do what entrepreneurs do best, solve unexpected problems in their business.
We were completely wrong.
And I'm just like, it's not selling.
It was like, we have to start from scratch.
I'm Jason Pfeiffer, the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine.
Whose timing, I'd say, is pretty good as far as careers go. I mean, you know, if you consider co-founding the financial payments company Square and now having a net worth that is considerably north of $1 billion to be good timing, then yeah, pretty good. But irony here, he wrote a book that had an element that examined timing that I really liked, that in fact, we excerpted in the magazine more than a year ago. And that book's timing was, well, not as good, but hard to control for. Did your book come out on the time
March
when everyone...
March 10th, like the day they were shutting down. I was literally in a studio when they closed, like they just like, were leaving.
Oh my gosh.
It was crazy.
That's horrifying. My wife released a book. I can't remember what hurricane it was. Some hurricane blew in the day that her book released, and we thought that was bad. But I suppose releasing the day everyone's fleeing a pandemic is perhaps worse.
The day the world shut down was when Innovation Stack dropped. But it was relevant as a topic. It just was a bad time.
In case you missed the title of that book there, it is The Innovation Stack. It's a great book. I really enjoyed it. It's a book about Jim and Square, but really a book about innovation. Wouldn't you believe it from the title? And how it happens and how to approach it. And a big part of that is timing. Because, you know, you're a little too early or you're a little too late and your innovation just isn't going to hit the way that it otherwise would have. And so, you know, like I said, a year ago, we ran an excerpt from that book in the magazine, and I wanted to circle back with Jim now and have a conversation about it, about that subject of timing and when to do something and when not to, because it is such an important subject. It's always an important subject, but I feel like even more so now because our sense of timing has perhaps become just crazy warped during the pandemic, right? I mean, like, there were people who felt like the pandemic was the absolute wrong time to do something and people who felt like the pandemic was the absolute right time to do something. And now that we're exiting out of the worst of it, at least in some parts of the world, we can, I don't know what, is now the better time? Did we miss the better time? Is the better time in the future? When? And I like that Jim has this philosophy, which is he doesn't ask the question, why now? Instead, he asks,
why not now? So I have a default to action. I have a default to trying it and doing it and saying it. It gets me in trouble sometimes.
But it's worked out more times than not. So today on Problem Solvers, I am talking to Jim McKelvey, author of The Innovation Stack, co-founder of Square, about when to ask why now, and also really when to ask why not now. And that's all coming up after the break. We all want to know that we have enough energy to get where we want to go. For example, you either have enough energy to run a marathon or you're on the side of the road wheezing. How about your startup? Does it have enough cloud computing to win and handle the really big customers? You might think stable, enterprise-ready cloud infrastructure like Oracle's is out of reach for your company, but Oracle for Startups was made just for you. Oracle wants to help you land those big customers, so they're offering preferred pricing on enterprise cloud for startups. Free cloud credits and 70% off their cloud services, and with multi-cloud support and no vendor lock-in. So you can build it out any way you want. Oracle for Startups doesn't want you wheezing on the side of the road. They want you to have enough power to scale and land your dream customer. So how do you get it? All you do is go to oracle.com/go-to/problem-solvers. Again, that is oracle.com/go-to/problem-solvers. All right, we're back. So today, talking to Jim McKelvey about timing, and in Jim's book, he opens the chapter about timing with this story about him taking this glass-blowing class with an absolute legend in the glass-blowing world.
He was an old Italian master, Lino Tagliapietra.
And Jim is a glassblower, so taking a class with Lino was an exceptionally big deal, as he'll explain in a second. But this moment, this one moment from this class really struck him and helped him reframe and understand timing. So I wanted him to share that story with you, too. Tell me that story, if you recall it.
Oh, I could tell you like it was yesterday, because first of all, you have to understand that in the glass world, Leno is a legend. He is the guy. As a matter of fact, a lot of the explanations for why we do the things that we do is just because we copied exactly what Leno was doing without question. So he is considered the fount of all knowledge. And in fact, really is, because until he came over to the US and taught the techniques, there was this sort of ghetto studio glass movement that was not making anything beautiful. And Leno came over and caused quite a controversy by teaching these thousand-year-old Venetian techniques.
What is your entry to glass blowing? It just seemed like a good meditative experience?
No, I started blowing glass when I was in college for fun. And then when I graduated college and started my first tech company, I needed money. And it was how I knew how to make money. So I was blowing glass and selling my work and using that to fund my first tech company.
Amazing.
So glass was my VC, which is sort of amazing. But in fact, it was true. And, you know, back in 1989, there was not this highly developed ecosystem that funds great ideas and young companies. And so that was how I stayed alive.
Is there a metaphor to be had here between glass and venture capital? Fragility?
You know, getting burned probably is a better one. But I think, look, I don't think my way is the way to do it anymore. Jack and I could have bootstrapped Square. We chose to take venture capital. I think it was a good decision, but it was certainly at the time the best option I had. And so I became a professional glassblower, but not really somebody who was itching to be an artist his whole life, but somebody who just needed money. And so I had always sort of idolized Leno and the, you know, sort of the Italian masters. And I got into one of his classes after being a professional glassblower for 15 years. So there was this decade and a half period where I was still making a living, but not ever having met the master. So I'd met people who had studied from Leno and I'd studied from them and all this stuff. And his class was kind of funny because it was taught at Haystack Mountain School of Crafts up in Deer Isle, Maine. Very difficult to get into his class. And then when I got there, you know, his assistant said, think about your question. And I was like, what question? He said, well, you get to ask the maestro one question. And yeah, I was like, oh God, I got 10 days with this guy. I get to ask one question. And the other students were equally pressured, but all the other students were constructing these very elaborate questions because they didn't want to waste it. So they were all doing this thing where it was like, maestro, how do you do this magical thing with glass? And in almost every case, it was something that was considered impossible. But of course, Leno is the best in the world and he can do it. Like, this is the thing about Leno. He doesn't even know how much he knows. You challenge. It's like, how high can a tiger jump? Like, as high as it needs to, right? that's just basically nobody knows, right? But Leno is this guy where if you challenge him, he always meets it. And then some of the demonstrations of the skill are just legendary. So I was all psyched out about having one question, but I couldn't get out of my head the fact that the thing I really wanted to ask was a super basic question, which was how to put a foot on a bowl. Like, this is a very basic thing. And I had been doing it for 15 years, but I was never comfortable. So I wasted my question with the world's best glassblower by asking this super basic thing. And I was expecting him to answer it the way he'd answered the other questions, which was through a demonstration. And instead, what he did was he told me to make a bowl and then to make a foot and to put the thing on. Like, he didn't touch the glass. All he said to me during the entire time was two words. First, he said, wait. He's obviously saying this in Italian. He says, wait. And I'm waiting, waiting. And I've got the hot foot in one hand and the cold piece on the other hand. And he says, now. And when he said, now, I let the glass fall and went on perfectly. And this was a mind-blowing experience because my technique had been fine. It was my timing that I wasn't paying attention to. So he corrected the timing and the technique took care of itself. And I'd been doing it right for 15 years, but getting crap results because I'd been doing it at the wrong time. And that night I went back to my, you know, little cabin on the water. It was just this crazy sort of contemplative space. And I thought about all the other places in my life where I was making an analogous mistake, where I had done the right thing at the wrong time. Because, you know, I was trained as an engineer. I'm a guy who knows how to make stuff. Okay, I build things. I can tell you if the bridge will stand. I can tell you how long the bridge will stand. I can tell you how long the mortar joints in the bridge are rated for. Like, I can do that calc and I know how to do a lot of stuff, but I don't always know when. So to me, the idea of timing was just mind-blowing. And from that date forward, and that was 20 years ago, I have become this fanatical student of timing. So I will work like crazy to learn how to do something. And then before I actually do it, I'll sit there and go, okay, is now the right time? Should I do it now? what about now? Like, should I wait? Because, I mean, really, the question is now or later, or never, I guess, is the answer. But I find that asking these questions has really given me an advantage in certain circumstances. Especially, I mean, you know, you get older, you get married, and I'm like, you better know how to time if you want to stay married, right? You can do the right thing at the wrong time. And if you are like, oh, that's exactly what I should have done tomorrow.
Yeah, but so the glass blowing thing is interesting because I suppose if you know anything about glass blowing, which you do and I don't, but I would imagine that the second that he said now, you were able to lock into your brain, this is the moment. I understand what is happening at now and I can replicate at now. But add a few more factors in. Be in a situation or an environment that maybe you haven't run through before, launching a company, running a company. How do you identify now?
So I changed the question for complicated equations and I ask it, why not now? So I have a default to action. I have a default to trying it and doing it and saying it. It gets me in trouble sometimes, especially with my sense of humor. Like I got to go through media training like once a year. Like it's just,
just to bring you back in line.
It's like, Jim, and I made a joke at a Fed conference the other day that would, I mean, I thought it was good. Actually, they all laughed, which doesn't happen that much at the Fed.
Yeah. But, it seems like hard people to make laugh.
You know, Jay's actually got a great sense of, he does. And, you know, back when we used to spend time together, when we were, you know, sort of meeting in person, I had breakfast, lunch, and dinner with the chairman, like, I think 4 meals in a row. And by that time, like, you've talked about your family, you've talked about everything. Like, so he just starts cutting up. Like, he's just hilarious. And it was so much fun. And before that, I got Janet Yellen. I think I was the only guy to ever get Janet Yellen to swear.
But amazing.
That was a great story. Janet's awesome. Like, thrilled to have her in Treasury now. But, you know, look, I make jokes, and jokes are timing. Jokes are things where if you hesitate to make fun of a situation, you will lose that moment where it's actually funny. So I try to default to saying it or doing it or trying it unless I have a good reason not to, because there's so many reasons to not do it. And I'm a procrastinator by nature. Like, I'm a guy who would probably still be asleep right now under slightly different circumstances. It's just... Yeah.
But a joke, yeah. So but this is funny because a joke, I mean, sometimes the reason a joke is funny is simply because you came up with it fast enough.
Yes. Yeah, you got to be fast on the draw.
Yeah. It's just people are laughing just because you moved quickly enough.
Yeah.
But does that translate anywhere else? Is that a business skill?
Of course it is.
You moved fast enough?
Of course it is. Of course it is. Oh, God. I mean, you got to be able to hit the ball that curves over the plate. So I'm pitching Peter Thiel, my current company.
Jim's current company is called Invisibly. It powers micropayments for online content.
And go through the whole pitch. And I think Peter was just playing with me. But at the end, he was like, well, Jim, we never invest in media companies. He listened to my whole pitch, which was in the media space. It was in the media space. It was trying to fix what is effectively journalism. And Peter,
small problem.
At the end of this huge, oh, it was a massive, but I actually came up with a fix for it. Like, it totally worked. It just required a massive risk. So I pitched it all to Peter, and he's a guy who takes massive risks. And he's like, Jim, we have a policy here at Founders Fund. We never invest in media companies. And I'm like, we're dead. And then the comic part of my brain said, Peter, ask yourself why you never invest in media companies. And he got silent for like 10 or 20 seconds. And then he's like, oh, so I guess we're coming to St. Louis now. I was like, yeah, bet your ass, man. But the whole idea was that, and I don't know what he was testing, if he was testing me as a leader to see if I could handle adversity, or if he had a legitimate objection, or if he had just never thought about it that way. And I actually sparked a new idea. Like, I don't know, but whatever it was, it worked. Okay. And if you don't practice swinging at real pitches, you're going to miss that one. And there were moments like that in Square too, where having been in all these situations and screwed up many situations, I was able to move when it counted. Now, I've also screwed stuff up. Like, I made a joke in one of our pitches that I think cost us funding from one of the better VCs. They couldn't make a joke. I can't tell you that one. They were so offended. It was one of these things, like, I thought I was complimenting a strength. Because, like, you never make fun of somebody's weakness. You always compliment them on their strength. So if I know you're sensitive about something, I would never joke about that. That's cardinal rule. I will never, ever attack a weakness. And I thought these guys had just, like, come to grips with the fact that this was the way the world worked. And they had not. And they were so pissed. I mean, it just iced the... It was terrible. Jack was furious.
Hey, it's me in real time interrupting this interview. So first of all, I guess there's a good lesson there. be careful with the jokes that you tell while you're fundraising. But also, I had gotten to wonder, as Jim was saying this, what the takeaway is after so many experiences of thinking and acting fast and having it work out sometimes and not work out other times. Overall, does he feel like this is how you should be? Like, what's the batting average of thinking and acting fast? You win some, you lose some. And he has a great answer to that, and I'm going to play it for you. But timing, I have to take a short break to hear from a sponsor. So when we come back, I will ask Jim that question. Hey, business owner. Did you know that over 4.2 billion people are active on social media right now? That means if you want to connect with your customers and find new ones, you need social. If you want to build loyalty and stand out for the competition, you need social. And if you want to make using social media easier and more impactful, well, you need Hootsuite. Hootsuite is the must-have tool for managing and growing your business on social. Hootsuite makes it easy to find your audience, whether on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, Twitter, YouTube, or Pinterest. You can schedule content, publish posts, and track your success all in one place. Millions of businesses around the world are already using Hootsuite to supercharge their social efforts, and now it is your turn. Go to hootsuite.com/problem solvers to start your free trial and get 50% off your first year. That is Hootsuite, I'm going to spell it, HOOTSUITE, hootsuite.com/problem solvers for a free 30-day trial and 50% off your first year. All right, we're back. So just before the break, Jim had been telling some stories about thinking and speaking quite quickly in important meetings. Sometimes it worked out, sometimes not so much. What it sounds like you have done is you've trained yourself. I'm going to float a theory by you, and then you're going to tell me if I'm right or not, because you've just given me a number of examples in which you thought fast, said something really fast, and got some kind of reaction. Sometimes that reaction leads to potential funding or better relationships or making Janet yell and laugh. And other times it is a loss, but it seems like you have figured out the batting average on this one. And you've decided that moving fast might lose you some, but it'll gain you more. Is that right?
It's how I choose to do it. I'm not saying I don't want to hold myself up as a role model, because I do get into trouble. And I do occasionally offend people unintentionally these days. I mean, I never go after somebody intentionally, but it happens. And I'll regret those moments. And I wince a lot about stuff that I've said and go, oh, I wish I had that back. But I think my life has been so enhanced by the ones that I have sort of shot and landed that it was on balance worth it. I mean, I met my wife, I guess it was 12 years ago. I was in Tokyo. It was White Day. Okay. White Day is a pre-Valentine. And I was in my friend's office in Tokyo, and my wife was working in this office, or my future wife was working in this office, and she had a piece of rice stuck to her face. Now imagine a beautiful girl going around an office unaware that there was this grain of sticky rice stuck to her cheek.
Yeah. It was like a very Tokyo problem.
It was a great moment. It was a great opening. And I walked up and I didn't say a thing. I just plucked the rice right off her face as a total stranger. And that's how it started. It could have gone horribly wrong.
Yeah, that could have gone a real couple different ways.
Oh my God, what a train wreck that could have been. But you know, now here we're married and happily so. So I've been rewarded for this.
Let's look at it from a different perspective. We've talked for a while now about the value of moving fast. When do you not do that?
Well, if you have a reason not to. If you think through the problem and you've really got something mastered, and which is usually something you've done repeatedly, then a lot of times you want to wait. You want to just pause. And, you know, St. Louis no longer has a football team, but back when we did and won the Super Bowl, it was with a running back named Marshall Faulk. And Faulk was not the biggest guy. He was not, you know, we hired this guy after him who was basically twice his size. Like, I think it was physically double this guy's mass. And he was ineffective. Faulk's beauty was that he would run. He would keep his legs moving, but he wouldn't actually move forward. And he would just pause a little bit and wait for the play to develop. And then he would take off. And sometimes that little pause makes all the difference. And timing is what you do a lot in glass blowing. Like if you watch, I guess Blown Away is sort of popular on TV, and some of my friends are on the show now, and it's cut really weird. Like it's not cut to show you how glass blowing is. It's cut to be good reality TV. A lot of the times they're just standing around, look like they're doing nothing. And what they're doing is they're letting the glass cool to a certain temperature or heat to a certain temperature. Like they're just letting the heat change it in a way that's necessary. And if you don't think about it, you think, oh, well, just do this step, then do this step, then do this step. But it's all about timing. So I really like this idea that if I've mastered something, the next thing that I learn is when to and when not to.
Right. You said that you asked this question, why not now?
Why not now?
So you have to have a good answer to why not now. This is something of a question to the question, but how do you know if you have the right answer to why not now? Because I'll tell you a common answer to why not now for somebody who is just starting out, say, and that is, well, I just don't think it's perfect yet. Or I just don't know that I'm ready yet.
Yeah.
And that is an answer, but it may not be a very good answer, right? Because of course, what's going to happen is that if you don't feel like you're ready, there's a chance that you will never feel like you're ready. So you just got to go out there and do it. So what's the litmus test for whether the answer to why not now is a real answer?
So let's phrase that as the specific, I'm not prepared. I could be more prepared. I could be better prepared for this. Like I walked up to my wife or my future wife and plucked a grain of rice off her face. I was dressed like a hobo. Like I just slept on an airplane. I was with my buddy who was depressed and had been keeping me up complaining all night. I could have presented better. Like mm-hmm. I could have come back the next day all spiffed up or something, but opportunity, you know, so there's always this lack of preparation. And there's also, interestingly enough, and this is why sort of the innovation stack focuses on the world of entrepreneurship, i.e. the world of things that cannot be copied. Because I really want to emphasize that there is no way to prepare for something that has not been done in any sort of meaningful way. So the people that I profiled in the book, and this wasn't just a random sampling, this was like everybody that I studied. I had 25 case studies for the book. I published 4 of them, but all the research led to this pretty obvious conclusion, right? Which is you can't be an expert in something that hasn't been done. So if you're sitting there saying, well, I'm not ready to go yet because I don't know enough about this thing. Well, great. Now let's talk about that thing. It falls into 2 categories. It's a thing that you can look up a video on YouTube and figure out how to do. Like others can teach you how to do this thing you don't know how to do. Like you don't know how to
screw in a light bulb.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking do that heart bypass surgery.
Sure. Okay. You know, a little more complicated.
Like, okay. So you don't know how to do heart bypass surgery. You might want to get trained and it might take 12 years, but you can then be trained and you can qualify to do it. But there's something, if it's something that has never been done before, then you can't get trained. You can't use that, I'm not prepared, because you're never going to be prepared. Now, does that mean it's impossible? No. It means that the first person to do this will do it unprepared. The first person to accomplish this thing in human history is going to do it without a resume that qualifies him or her for having taken that action. And that's the excuse that I try to suss out, because that one is so baked into who we are. Because I mean, like I got 2 kids right now. I've got a bunch of friends and I do this myself all the time. I constantly disqualify myself from doing things that I'm not prepared to do. And then I have to sit there and say, well, wait a second, Jim, is this legit? I.e., is this something I can be prepared to do and I'm just being lazy and haven't done the work? Or is this something that I just feel awkward because, hey, nobody's pulled this off before and you're going to be the first. So you're just going to have to live with this awkward feeling. And that's the excuse that I want to sort of default out of my questions. So why not now really helps.
And situate this when you're thinking about people doing something that hasn't been done before. You're thinking innovators, you're thinking people who are creating something that doesn't exist. But I assume you also put into that category, look, somebody who is at the very beginning of this journey, they're launching a business. Somebody could tell you how to launch a business, right?
Oh, yeah.
But they can't tell you exactly how to launch your exact business. Hasn't existed before. And therefore, there are factors.
Well, it depends on what that business is. So you want to open a tire shop. Well, okay. I mean, you're going to compete with Tire Rack, so good luck with that. But I mean, you're also in a world where there are literally thousands of places that have Hunter equipment and you can change a tire and balance the wheels. And like, you can do all that stuff. And Hunter's got training videos. So you want to spin balance wheel, they'll send you a video on it. So it's possible to get trained in a lot of this stuff. And if you don't know what you're doing, you go hire somebody from the other tire shop, you know, to come work for you, right? So let's contrast the tire shop with somebody who's trying to figure out how to build something that hasn't been built yet. And that's a different way of thinking. It's a different way of acting. And unfortunately, the advice you get from the tire shops of the world, from the places that have figured out the formula, it's almost like we always assume there's a formula. And look, for most of our lives, there is. But sometimes I think there's not. And the whole point of the book is we're all born with this survival instinct. We're not born as entrepreneurs. We're not born as innovators. We're not born as like all these, you know, sort of heroes and titans of industry. What we're born at is people who don't want to die. Okay. So you take somebody who is in, I mean, we've seen, unfortunately, too much of it this year, but, you know, spend some time in places where people's lives are threatened and watch what they will do. And in those situations, we all have this survival instinct. And if you're in business and your business life is threatened, if your company's existence is threatened, you have this amazing ability to respond to this existential threat. And so I wanted to sort of talk to those people because one, they've got more interesting stories. And two, they're the ones who do the cool stuff that hasn't been done before. So that's a fascinating place to be. Oh, and three, they tend to get like mega rich, just insanely. Like everyone I studied, I was like, oh my God, richest guy on the planet in several of the cases. And they were not experts. They're just not experts. So don't disqualify yourself because you're not an expert. And it took me 300 pages to say that, but on your podcast.
Now you summarized it quite well. Jim, let me wrap up with this. You described in the beginning of our conversation becoming or realizing that you wanted to become a student of when, understanding timing. How has that changed your own approach to anything, to life, to business?
I never interrupt anymore. That's a big one. For some reason, if somebody, I have so trained myself to sit on what I have to say, which I used to think was so important. I now, if anyone wants to take the air or take the microphone, they take it. As a matter of fact, it's terrible because sometimes I'm on stage with these people who just want to talk. You know, I don't do panels anymore. I hate panels. Yeah. Hate them. Like unless you have somebody moderating that panel. By the way, I will moderate a panel.
Sure.
I will interrupt anyone who's being boring, but I've trained myself never to interrupt. Just collect as much information as you can. The fact that people can proceed and succeed without foreknowledge doesn't mean that you should not seek knowledge, right? So I think that's been sort of the most noticeable personal change. And then the other thing is it gets easier with practice to move, to learn to react. And in the glass studio, you have to because you spend all these 20 minutes or an hour setting up this moment where you're going to make the final shape and it's either going to succeed or fail based on decisions over a couple of seconds. And if you hesitate at all, you lose those couple of seconds. You just don't get that back. So that's been sort of helpful in sort of mental conditioning because I literally spend a couple days a week with an object or with a material, I should say, that doesn't forgive slow. Like if you miss your timing window in the glass studio, it's trash.
Yeah.
Right.
So
we just learned to act. And I'll be an hour and a half into a piece where I've done all this prep work and then I still have to make this move correctly in order to finish it. And I'm nervous as hell because I was like, God, I only get like three of these a day. And this is my one attempt. And I know it's either now or never. And I'm, but it's like managing that moment. And look, I don't think the book's going to prepare people to sort of manage these moments, but at least if they recognize them, then over time you get better. Just this idea of having a temporal component to the things you're observing will help you learn.
And then you get to the place where you feel like, I mean, to go back to the very, very beginning, right? You had enough raw knowledge, not just raw knowledge, but expert knowledge about how to make that bowl and the foot that at that point, what you just needed was the mindset of focusing on the timing, that was a factor that had to be taken as seriously as any other factor.
Yeah, I had to wake up. And unfortunately, it cost me my question. That's the only question I got to ask Lino.
But it turned out to be a great one.
I've made a lot of progress. I think that question may be the reason we have Square. I think it may be the reason we have a few other things. I don't know. That was many years ago, but it's just a great place to look. Because look, school's going to teach you how. People are going to teach you. YouTube will teach you how. You can do how, but do you know how to do when?
Jim, thanks so much for your time.
Just super.
Thanks again to Jim McKelvey. Again, his book is called The Innovation Stack. And although it came out in the beginning of the pandemic, which was not good timing, the good timing about it is that, of course, you can find it now or anytime, wherever you find books.
And that's our episode. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to Problem Solvers wherever you get your podcasts. We come out with a new episode every Monday morning and you don't want to miss it. And hey, be kind. Pass the show along to an entrepreneur friend who could use a boost. And did you solve a problem that would be good for this show? Let me know about it. Visit my website, jasonfeiffer.com, JasonFeiffer.com, where you can find my contact information and all sorts of other valuable info. Problem Solvers is a production of Entrepreneur Media. Be sure to visit entrepreneur.com for all all your entrepreneurship needs. And even better, subscribe to our magazine, which is just full of the smartest entrepreneurs solving the toughest problems. My name is Jason Pfeiffer, the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine. Thanks for listening. And hey, let's go solve some problems.